On today's show, Ben Elwood and I continue our deep dive director series as we take a close look at David Lynch's Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me. My name is Justin Hamilton, and we're not going to talk about Judy at all here on Big Squid. Welcome to the podcast, and look, I know I'm coming from a specific position when I say this, but I think this is one of the most interesting chats I've had all season with Ben, and I think this is because we are initially coming from a very similar angle, but I don't want to give anything away, but I think there's... Even though we're coming from a similar angle, there is a different kind of timbre to what we're thinking. There's a different kind of texture. And so we end up having this really interesting talk about this movie. And even though I totally agree with Ben's initial assessment, I ended up taking into account Twin Peaks, The Return, and my readings of David Lynch's work that we've been experiencing in the lead up to this movie. And so I come to a slightly different conclusion, and then I share that with Ben at the end. So look, even if you're not a Twin Peaks fan, or maybe you just haven't seen this movie or TV show in a while, I think you'll enjoy this discussion. Heck, it might even inspire you to check them out again or watch the movie for the first time. I was talking to Beck Hunt. Hello, Beck. Over the weekend, and she told me that sometimes she listens to the podcast to work out if she wants to watch a movie. And there's a few of you who do that, actually, and you'll listen and you'll think, you know what, I will give that movie a go. And then there's some movies we talk about where you're like, nah, fuck that, I am out of here. But all valid reactions to everything we talk about, whether it's TV, movies, etc. I should have looked this up before I started recording. I'll see if I can find it really quickly. But someone in our private Facebook page said that they just started watching Severance. And man, good on you. Like, how exciting. Like, I'm so jealous that there was Alan Halstead who said that he went to the cinema for the first time in 2.5 years and saw Everything Everywhere All at Once and had a great time. So good work, Alan. I'm really, really pleased that you checked that out. But anyway, I can't find who it is. But whoever you are is watching Severance, I saw your message, and good on you. I hope you're enjoying it as much as I did. But anyway, I've gone off on one of those many tangents that I like to do over the course of this podcast. But so you might listen to what we're talking about tonight. You might not have seen this movie in a while. Look, it's confronting in many ways, but it is fascinating. It is ahead of the curve, and for a movie that was absolute flop, that I also will admit to something in the heart of our discussion. I loved it. So I hope you enjoy this chat. Before we launch into that discussion, a quick reminder, I'm on my way to Adelaide, back to the hometown, where they pronounce Lego correctly. On the 3rd of June, I'm performing at the Rhino Room. The show starts at 7 p.m. And then I've organised with the people who promote the room, g'day Craig Egan, and the team behind the scenes. They're going to keep the front bar open afterwards, so if you'd like to come along to the show and say hi, please do so. And also, my listeners can use the promo HAMMO, H-A-M-M-O, HAMMO, to get discounted tickets. So head over to adelaidecomedy.com and make sure you apply that sweet big squid treat. Save some money. Buy yourself a drink. Laugh at my shit. What a great night. And, you know, make sure you stick around and say hi. We've actually had a recent surge in Patreon subscribers, which has been fantastic. Thank you very much to all of our new Patreon subscribers. It's very sweet to have you sign up, and it's really appreciated. And all my subscribers have an episode dedicated to them, and today's shout-out goes to Philip Boothby. Thanks, Philip, for your patronage. I hope you enjoyed this podcast, especially my attempts to win Ben over to my views about this movie and the saga of Laura Palmer in general. You're getting a spirited podcast, Philip. So thank you very much. My friends and I appreciate the support, and I hope you're enjoying the work we're doing here and also the work that's coming up. We have a new Beautiful Tales for the Disenchanted that's coming up very soon, and I heard some preliminary production by Sean Allen on that new story. It's called Squeak. It's on its way. Patreon supporters have already heard a work in progress of it. For those of you who already listened to that, it's even better. Like, it sounds so, how can I describe it? It's grubby. It's a grubby story. I'll tell you what it's about. It's about two awful clowns at the bottom of a rubbish tip, slowly dealing with another dead clown. So, you know, what I want to do with Beautiful Tales for the Disenchanted is give you all sorts of different stories, because I like all sorts of different stories. So I want to explore that with my work. And so that's coming up soon as well, Philip. So keep an ear and eye out for that. And yes, all Patreon supporters have access to bonus podcasts. Sometimes it's like this week, we dropped a new Dispatches from the Fury Road podcast. For those of you who go to my website, bigsquidpod.com, you will probably see that as a blog, but the Patreon supporters get a much longer and, some might say richer version, some might say a wafflier version. Is wafflier a word? It is now. So you can get bonus podcasts, you can get scripts and more, etc. So if you'd like to be a part of the community, head over to patreon.com/JustinHamilton_BigSquid, and you can find a tier that suits you. I'll be back at the end of the podcast for updates on what is coming next, but in the meantime, let's join FBI agent Desmond as he visits Deerfield, Washington to investigate the murder of a young girl. While he searches for the killer, Agent Dale Cooper must face his chilling dreams about the murderer striking again. Unbeknownst to the FBI, the beautiful Laura Palmer attempts to make sense of her life as her fate casts a large shadow over the town she lives in. It's time to take a journey into Twin Peaks. Fire, walk with me.
Secret diary. That page is missing.
There is no other person who could have known where it was.
Did Bobby give you this? Or is there someone new?
Your Laura disappeared. It's just me now.
You made me write it all down.
Don't do that. She doesn't like that.
How do you know what she likes?
Just like my Laura.
It's your
Don't make me do this!
Mm-hmm.
Now, before we launch into this, a couple of things. Mm-hmm. One is, you know, you and I aren't particularly fans of warnings before movies or TV shows. It happened in a TV series recently where they warned that there was going to be a depiction of suicide. And so I just sat there and then it was like, oh, that person's going to attempt suicide.
Oh,
and
like a spoiler alert.
Well, they put it at the start as a warning in case it triggers you. And then I sat all the way through the episode going, oh, well, it's going to be them. And then when it happened, like it was well done. But if that warning hadn't been there, I would have been like, oh my God. But instead, I was like, oh, we're building up to that. And oh yeah, right. But that to me is a little bit different with this because a podcast can be listened while you're driving, you might be on public transport, you might be out in public. We are going to be talking about Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. I've already said this. I've, in the future, when I do the intro for this, there's going to be a warning there as well. But just in case, once again, you're out and about and you didn't quite clock that warning, here's the re-warning. We are going to be talking about some pretty heavy themes and some pretty confronting things that happen in this film. And I just need you to know, as the listener, we want you to be... I also promise you, I have something very positive to bring to it. And
Good, because I'm looking forward to hearing that.
No, I have a complete reinterpretation of Twin Peaks. Complete reinterpretation.
Great.
And it is, you know... so anyway, so we're going to be talking about some grotty things. David Lynch is a director who I don't think there's any... Like, I just don't trust anyone who says, this is what the movie means. Because he doesn't make those kinds of movies. The movies can mean lots of things.
Yeah, 100%.
And also, there's a reinterpretation of these movies as you grow as a person.
Yes.
Which we will get into about this... pretty close with the first question once we start. So, but anyway, just in case you're out and about or you're feeling a bit shit and you don't feel like anything too heavy, you know what? Go and listen to our episode where we talk about E.T. You know? Go back and listen to the E.T. episode.
Even the Thing episode is the very Thing enjoyable. Episode.
You know? Like, we're still there and we're still here when you need us. So, but there are some full-on things to interpret in this. Something else I wanted to bring up was I started working with a 26-year-old girl at The Chase, who's lovely.
Yes.
Crazy smart, like crazy smart. Really into cinema. And it was interesting. She can't get into David Lynch. And and I, not to go into too much backstory, but with all the movies that she likes, and she likes some really great movies, it's interesting... because his movies are quite surreal and there is a dream logic to them.
Nightmare logic.
Well, yeah. I could completely understand how she's probably... And we discussed this, and this wasn't a patronizing thing. I think she will come around to Lynch as she gets older and has more life experience and also movie experience. And so... That is a roundabout way of leading us into the first question, which is, when did you first see this film and what was your reaction at the time?
I don't think I saw this until just before the return.
Right.
So what, 2016 or so. Yep. But this is the third time I've seen this movie and I don't think that the movie affected me at all until last night when I saw it.
Right.
It fucked me up, man. It really messed me up.
You watched it pretty late too.
Yeah, and you know, I've had some stuff going on, so a bit doughy and vulnerable.
Yeah,
but I think it was the first time I was able to watch it free of the. It's funny saying this because how can you watch it free of the influence of Twin Peaks? But watching it just as a film rather than a sequel to Twin Peaks or a bridge between Twin Peaks season 2 and 3.
Right.
Like I really went into it thinking, you know, does this actually just work as a film?
Yeah.
Like, you know, can you get into these characters without knowing, without all the baggage and just take them as they're presented to you in this film without any prior knowledge? And I watched it through that lens this time. And I think the dream logic and the nightmare logic of it really affected me this time. Trying to just forget everything I knew about Laura Palmer or Bobby or anyone. And so the kind of the implication of certain things affected me a lot more.
Right.
Like, it really... I basically spent 2.25 hours last night feeling nauseous and and terrified.
Yeah.
Terrified. Like, I verbally yelled out at many points in this movie, knowing full well that a scare was about to come.
Right.
But, you know, there's that certain shot where Laura's walking up the stairs and the drone is going hell for leather and the fan's whipping. And
right.
You know that Bob's in the room. You know that he's there.
Yeah.
And yet, when he appeared, I verbally yelled out. It was fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
Horrifying. And then, of course, everything that is implied in this film is so, so disturbing and so upsetting. And weirdly, I think, much like we've talked about with Lynch's previous stuff, what this actually is about, or, you know, one of the things that it's about, is so heavy and so twisted and evil and dark that the expressionistic depiction of it makes you feel the way you should feel watching a movie about this topic. Rather than a more kind of realistic, quote unquote, depiction of it.
Yeah.
This kind of surrealistic nightmare, I think, is apropos for what it's about.
You can watch this movie as, if you don't know anything about Twin Peaks, about a poor girl that has been abused all her life and she has created this world as a place to cope.
Yep.
And that's how you can, even though the place that she has created is awful, it's also, she's created it to be bigger than it is, which somehow gives what she's going through some form of meaning.
Yeah. And also, you know, the whole kind of Leland, her father, and this demonic presence of Bob.
Yeah.
Again, if you're watching it free of Twin Peaks and knowing that Bob is this demonic entity, it becomes this kind of representation of this darkness that's inside this man.
Yeah.
It's I think the series depicts it as that he is infected with some kind of entity.
Yeah.
Some kind of external entity. Yeah. Whereas the film very much gives you the impression of, like, oh no, this is something that is him, that is innate in him, that bubbles to the surface. And then the regret, and you see that with a lot of abuse.
Yes.
Whether it's, you know, physical abuse or sexual abuse or whatever, the perpetrator will often kind of, you know, express remorse after the fact.
Yeah.
You know, or try and make it better or whatever. And then, you know, the whole cycle just repeats and repeats.
Yeah. This is actually a really hard movie to write a script for it's like there were so many times, like, remember, I only had the opportunity to write this yesterday and I contacted you pretty early saying, okay, I'm going to start this. I've got a few other things on today. And then what was it? Like 10:30? I said, finished. I was like, Jesus, this has been, but there were so many rabbit holes where you go down into this, the Twin Peaks mythology.
Yeah.
And this movie is actually, and we'll get to that a little bit more later, is very important to the mythology, but there were so many rabbit holes that I went down where I'd be like, Jesus, like, we actually don't need this, but all of this has been so fascinating, blah, blah, blah. So I saw this film at the cinema when it was first released, and I hated it.
Yep.
Like, I honestly hated it.
Yep.
I was there to find out what happened to Dale Cooper.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted, and I did not get that. In all honesty, and I'll make lots of dad jokes later, there was not enough David Bowie, even though he'd been... but he was in all the promos.
Yeah,
and you go and
course.
You get... What? Why did you promote someone who's in it for fucking 4 minutes?
Yeah, sure.
And but then also it was like, why is Chris Isaac only in this for 15 minutes?
Yeah, yeah.
And why is Kyle MacLachlan in this for 9.5 minutes? What the fuck is happening here? And... also, I just didn't understand why we were focusing on Laura Palmer, because she was dead.
Sure. How? So you would have been quite young.
So when did this come out?
It was 92.
So I was 19.
Yeah.
And
right.
I would. So
that's a 19-year-old guy's reaction to this film, I think.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because I'd seen the Twin Peaks European version of the movie. Loved it. Watched the series.
Yeah.
And you know what? Like, at the time, still enjoyed season two. Like, it did feel like it got a bit weird, like, not good weird in the middle.
Yeah.
But I still really enjoyed the first lot of episodes.
Yeah.
And I was into finding out who killed Laura Palmer. That's what I wanted to feel, and that's what I wanted to know, because that is what a young person wants. I want some fucking answers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I got too many questions in my real life. I want some fucking answers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then the way it ended, and then discovering it wasn't coming back, it was like, oh, well, I need to find out what has happened to Dale Cooper, because I love Dale Cooper. Yeah. I ended up naming one of our dogs after Dale Cooper.
Sure.
And then fucking, like, they didn't even go near it. And I'm, like, sitting there going, what the fuck just happened?
But isn't that profound, right, to realise that it was never Dale's story?
It's
Laura's story.
Well, you know, so when Twin Peaks The Return was about to air, I re-watched the movie and, you know, by that stage, I'm, like, 20-plus years older.
Mm.
And this is what I mean about this new co-worker, it's not being patronizing. The reason I say this about the co-worker and Lynch is because it happened to me, which is I knew more about cinema. I knew more about life.
Yeah.
And when I rewatched it, I did an incredible 180. Like it was
100%,
someone needed to come and put me in traction. I couldn't believe it. The only reason I watched it was because there was a hint that it was important to the new series. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'll sit through the movie again. And it was, oh, shit, this is...
It's brilliant. I think it's like top three of his films. I think it's so... And I only really appreciated that last night.
Yeah.
How brilliant it actually is.
And it's a really important movie in the Twin Peaks mythology. It's like there's the TV series, the first two seasons.
Yeah.
Then there's this movie.
Yeah.
And then it's, you know, it's like, you know how I talk about Rachel Dawes' death in the trilogy sends The Dark Knight into a different direction.
Yes.
This movie then sends us into Twin Peaks The Return. I wonder if I had not watched the movie, if I would have actually enjoyed Twin Peaks The Return.
I don't think, because I think Twin Peaks The Return is more of a sequel to this movie than it is of the original series.
Yes.
It's because again, it's the movie is the first kind of shot in the air of telling you you're not going to get what you want. You think you know what you want.
Yeah.
We're not giving you what you want.
Yeah.
And I think your experience is very common. From what I understand, this movie was not well received at all. Mm-mm. And then there's been a huge critical reappraisal.
Yeah, we'll get into that in the squid bits.
A decade and a half later.
Yeah.
People going, oh, wait a sec. This is like something else.
Like 2 decades later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is. It's really hard to watch it. You know, I mean, I wouldn't even... If anyone's listening to this and they haven't watched it in a while and they're thinking of doing like a whole Twin Peaks rewatch, I almost think that this... Something in this film is diminished if you watch it in quote-unquote order.
Right.
Like season 1, 2, then the movie, then season 3. I feel like there's more to be gained from this just watching it as a movie.
Right.
And, you know, if you know what you know about the characters, that's fine. But, yeah, I just... free of some of that kind of in-the-moment baggage of remembering everything about the series because you've just watched it. It's a remarkable movie.
You know, I disliked this movie when I first saw it so much that I ummed and ahed about seeing Lost Highway, which ended up being one of my favorite David Lynch films.
Yeah,
like, crazy that I was like, all right.
Do you remember if you, when you were that young man, if you had like a visceral negative reaction to what it's depicting? Like, is that one of the reasons you hated it? Because it's like this young coworker that you talk about not liking Lynch. And I think it's true that as you get older, maybe you're more open to different types of moods that a movie can put you in.
Yeah.
And I think to really get on board with this movie, you have to kind of... There's almost a perverse part of you that enjoys sitting there for 2.25 hours feeling like shit.
Yeah. Well, I think she's probably only watched Mulholland Drive and just went, oh, that made me feel a bit gross. I wasn't into that at all. And I looked at her and said, do not watch Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me.
Or Lost Highway. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Or Inland Empire. And I haven't even seen that one yet. But what I hear is terrifying things.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I saw... Because social media suggests things that you don't really want.
Yeah.
And sometimes, look, to be honest, sometimes, say, Twitter will suggest something because you like David Lynch and you'll go, oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah,
you know, Inland Empire's about to be released on Criterion. That was great. But then I saw a thread of someone saying, oh, a review of Inland Empire, oh, like, doesn't he know how to film? And doesn't he realize that there's better quality film to use it? And and then someone's come in, nah, it's okay, he filmed this during COVID. And it's like, oh, okay, that explains it. Anyway.
You know that he made 9 movies before this movie, right? Yeah, like, he knows really, how to make a fucking movie.
Yeah, it was really funny. But anyway.
Oh, goodness.
Well, let's get into the opening of the film, which starts with an axe smashing a TV. Yeah. Like...
talk about a statement, right?
Well, and also the most obvious metaphor in any David Lynch film. It's like, you know, I say a lot of weird things that you have to interpret, but here is an axe smashing a TV.
Yeah.
Twin Peaks, lived on TV, I'm about to smash you.
Yeah, yep.
And you know what? I'll just be honest. I didn't get that the first time I watched the film. Just and to me, that reveals that I wasn't smart enough for it. I just thought, oh, fuck, they smashed the TV, you know?
Yeah.
And also the first scene is this, is also just of Lynch as Gordon Cole looking to one side, yelling out basically to his cast, let's start the movie.
Yeah. God, it really affected me seeing him so young and puffy and...
yes.
And then kind of... like, I know 30 years is a long time, but it's not a long time. And it was like, oh, my God. Like,
yeah.
You see clips of him on YouTube now, and he's an old man.
He's an old man. Well, that keep that in mind, because that's going to come into play with my reinterpretation of where I feel Twin Peaks is for me.
Great.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's a hell of a statement, and it's almost like the anti-HBO start, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, look at this statement. Oh, my God. I knew it was coming, and I still jump.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yeah. Early it's the sound on, design.
It's, yeah.
His are the only jump scares that actually freak me the fuck out.
Right.
Because it's similar to, we were talking a couple of weeks ago about Alien and that mounting dread.
Yes.
And I think Lynch does a similar thing in, you know, that moment I talked about with Bob.
Yeah.
Because it is technically a jump scare. She peers around the door, the music goes, and he's just there.
Yeah.
But it's the drone leading up to it.
Yeah.
So you're already, it's not like, da-da-da-da-da-da, blah, oh, whoa.
Yeah.
It's, you're already wanting to throw up from horror. And then the jump scare, you know, it's the final release of the dread that's been building. It's fucking God. Brilliant.
Yeah. I think I've mentioned it later on, and we'll get to it, but the one of the most inspired scenes I've seen in a film is in this, which is when they're at a club and they need subtitles.
Oh, it's brilliant.
But you can kind of hear what they're saying, but it's like... it makes you feel like you're there.
Yeah, and like and kind of off your head as well.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The kind of weird non sequiturs that they're saying.
Yeah.
And like, you know.
And I think another reason this movie probably didn't resonate with me was because it was like Twin Peaks was scary, but as you have kept using the word horror, like this is a horror movie.
It's a fucking horror movie, yeah.
Whew. Early on, we meet Chester Desmond, as played by Chris Isaac, who is in the middle of arresting 2 street workers and a school bus driver while the school kids freak out. This is pretty funny.
Yeah.
To meet a character while this is going on and you're like, immediately your first thought is, what just went down?
Yeah. Are they turning tricks on the bus?
Like, and all the kids are screaming. It's like, are they screaming because there's something aggressive happening?
Yeah.
Have they made friends with these street workers? You know, maybe some of these kids were going to, like, they've paid up, you know? Like, I don't know.
I want a refund.
It's also, once again, even though it's really funny, and, you know, it's got Chester having to pull the phone away from his ear while Gordon yells
on
at
lower
him.
The antenna as though that's going to lower the volume. What are you doing?
It's a funny scene. It's also a reminder that it's not just Twin Peaks that is messed up. This whole world is messed up. Chet is introduced to Sam Stanley, who's played by Kiefer Sutherland. Underrated Kiefer Sutherland performance as
all
well.
All those weird little ticks.
Well, especially because, once again, he's in the movie for like a minute and a half.
Yeah.
But Sam Stanley, I fully buy into that character.
Mm.
And when you think about Kiefer Sutherland, who is like one of the most masculine actors around, and he is a dweeb.
And he's
really good at it.
It reminds me of the performance that he puts in Dark City.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does too. Yeah, yeah. Good one. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that movie in a while. Yeah, it is like that, isn't it? I would have been right into, like, if Twin Peaks had progressed, I would have really been into
the spin-off series.
Oh, Chester and Sam, you know, was other FBI agents that come in. I would have been totally into a 100%. Spin-off.
Chris Isaak's fucking great.
Just, you know,
what a fucking hunk.
He is also slightly not good enough as an actor to be perfect for a David Lynch role. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Totally.
You know, all his line delivery is mildly incorrect, and it's great.
Yeah, it's great.
So they receive clues from Lil the Dancer, who communicates in code that this is a Blue Rose case. Mm. And this is actually the first mention of the Blue Rose cases in the Twin Peaks mythology.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone talks about the X-Files, you know, but this feels like the scene, doesn't it? Where 100%. It's like, I don't know what it is, but I have been fascinated ever since I was a kid with the amalgamation of rigid law enforcement having to deal with the unknown.
It's the contrast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm reading a book written by an Australian journalist. I can't think of the title at the moment, but it's all about all the different UFO sightings throughout the decades and stuff that happened in bright day in Melbourne and all this stuff that's been covered up and around American bases. And it's like, it's...
It just kind of... Isn't it incredible that we all wanted the answers for so many decades and now we're in just like this information flood zone that they finally said, yeah, they're real. And it hasn't even...
And no one blinked.
No one gives a shit. No one even talks about it.
It's insane.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. We've talked about UFOs, right? I told you I've seen a UFO.
I don't think you have said those magical words.
Yeah,
to
yeah, yeah, yeah. Me and me, Nick Sun and Jen Wong all saw a UFO and tracked it in the sky for about 45 minutes about in 2006.
Right.
So we went for a drive, sat on Newport Beach, and we were all just sitting on in a row looking at the stars, and then all of a sudden this one star was moving and we're like, oh, it's an airplane, and then it started making crazy movements, like VH1 music ball, like bouncing through the sky, making weird triangular patterns.
Oh, right.
Zooming forward, then zooming backwards. It was simultaneously the most kind of T-boning moment of like, what the fuck? And then extra surreal, because after about 5 minutes, it becomes so normal. And you're just there going, oh, okay, now it's moving up and to the left. And now it's, you know, making triangles. And it was crazy. Nick started freaking, like really started freaking out.
Really? Right. Yeah. Is that about the point where Nick Sun decided, I'm never going to say a sentence that makes sense on stage again?
Well, because I started yelling out, take us up. And he's like, shut the fuck up, man.
Oh, yeah.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
And our friend Jen was there and she's like, look, it was just me and Nick, I'd be like, whatever, we're tripping out or something. And we had a shared hallucination. But the fact that she was there, total straight edge, totally sober, was just like, no, this is happening.
Wow.
And then it was just kind of like after 45 minutes, you're just kind of like, well, what do we do? I guess we just get in our car and go home and just kind of put that in the what the fuck was that file.
Wow.
Very strange. It moved like drones do now.
But there weren't drones.
But there weren't drones in 2006. I mean, the best I can come up with is it was some kind of like military... You know, militaries are usually 10, 20 years ahead of 10.
Yes.
It was like some kind of military drone that was out on some kind of flight. I don't think it was a fucking alien going... buzzing around for 40... But it wasn't a plane and it wasn't a star.
Right.
And it wasn't anything that I am aware that existed in 2006.
Right.
It was very surreal.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's great.
It was fucking great.
I'll have to see if that pops up in the book. I'll keep an eye out for 2006. Maybe it was God playing on his screen, playing one of those fruit games, Fruit Ninja, and then he realized he'd put his screen on scene. Oh shit. Turned it off. Man, if I'd been there, you know my ultimate dream is to be taken up by aliens and given superpowers so I can come back and save everyone. I'm good to go. If there's any aliens listening to this, like even if the surgery is painful, as long as I have powers at the end that I can do some good, I'm ready. Deer Meadow is very different to Twin Peaks, with law enforcement nowhere near as helpful. Hap's Diner is also not like the double R diner in Twin Peaks. And when I was doing research about this, because I was kind of you know, this is where we start to get really into the doubles of of storytelling in Twin Peaks. Like, this is where it really starts to cement itself. And I was thinking about Dear Meadow being like the awful reflection of Twin Peaks. And then while I was doing some research, I in some one article I read online, and I can't remember which one it was, but someone said, this is like the equivalent of starting the Simpsons movie with 30 minutes of being bummed out in Shelbyville.
Totally. It's totally, absolutely. No, it is. Those gross police people. What does he say? We got to ring someone. Oh, yeah. I'll give it a ring. Ring that bell.
Oh, my God. Like, they're the opposite of the sweet Andy and Sheriff.
And even the warm, beautiful double R diner sign, you know, is replaced with this half-burnt out crying clown.
Yeah. You know, it's not Peggy Lipton. It's this lady with cigarette-stained teeth. Yeah, what the fuck?
We don't have any specials.
So all of that is really funny.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it is a parallel universe for Twin Peaks. And then we can contrast the dead body of Teresa Banks with the peaceful-looking corpse of Laura Palmer. Mm. And that is when it takes a crazy turn for me, because I find looking at the dead body of Teresa Banks one of the most confronting scenes in any movie and also in any David Lynch production, from the way she appears to still be mid-screen and the way the nail is peeled back to reveal the letter T, and somehow that she's missing a ring is also like, that is the most normal part of this moment, and even that creeps me out.
Yeah, well, it's rare in film that you see a corpse that has an expression of horror on their face, and all that implies, that their last minutes and seconds were, you know, not that any kind of violent death is serene, obviously, but just the effect that it has on you as the viewer, seeing, you know, the way corpses are usually depicted in like a CSI type show or whatever, where they've got the kind of closed eyes and the closed mouth, as you say, mid scream. It's, you know,
oh, so much.
It's awful.
So the scene that I was when I was watching that I was thinking of in something else, which is another one of the descendants of Twin Peaks, was the first season of True Detective, which, you know, I love. And there's the bit with Russ Cole where he's doing all this research, and he talks about when you look in a dead person's eyes at the very last minute, they welcome it because they know they can shuffle off and can be beyond everything. And I was looking at that thinking, well, Russ obviously did not see Teresa Banks.
Yep, absolutely.
But it's also, once again, there's all these reminders early on, this is not going to be what you expect. There's something very fascinating about that. I don't know if there's any right or wrong, but not giving people what they want, to me, is far more interesting and brave than doing exactly what everyone wants. But I think you and I are definitively in the minority with that.
I just think it's something you have to come to.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, I don't think that your first reaction is wrong. Like, if you really are expecting a thing and then the thing is not the thing.
Yeah.
You know, and there is a fine line between, you know, subverting expectation and just...
And then rubbing your face.
Yeah, and being a fucking troll. Massive
fucking Lynchian shit.
Yeah. I just think it's... I just think if the only criticism that you have of a piece of work is that it was not what you were expecting, then you owe it to yourself and to the piece of work to revisit it and judge it again, now that you do know what it is.
I just think it's a
flawed critique to hate something because it wasn't what you thought it was going to be. Well, guess what? You're not the fucking artist. So.
Well, there's a possibility that I could have rewatched it many years later and still not enjoyed it.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
But you would have known what was coming.
But I knew what was coming.
And you knew that it wasn't going to be the continued adventures of Dale Cooper.
Yeah. I feel that way about albums. You know, like sometimes when I listen to an album by an artist I really like, maybe the first listen, I'll be a bit like, oh, okay.
Mm.
And then it'll take subsequent re-listens and, yeah.
Like, I know that a lot of people, I mean, I don't have a horse in the race, so you know my feelings on Star Wars, but they don't, they hated that Rian Johnson Star Wars because it subverted expectations. And again, I get people the first time going, but then a lot of people would watch it the second, third, fourth time and go, no, I still fucking hate it.
Right.
And that's that then becomes a valid criticism to me. Yeah. It's like, well, you know, now you know that it's kind of, you know, saying fuck you to all the questions you had from the first one.
Well, it's funny because let's not devolve too much into a Star Wars chat, but what's fascinating about that film is that, like, with David Lynch, it's like, well, of course he's going to give me what he's going to give me. But with Star Wars, it's like, why now?
Yeah, don't.
Why are you experimenting now? Yeah. Like, I don't really give a shit one way or the other.
Yeah.
But there is a part of me that thinks, well, why didn't you just continue this third trilogy with a traditional set of movies and then give Rian Johnson
a spin-off.
That's, you know, and then you can subvert all of those things, like, you know.
That trilogy, that proves that institution, you know, all these people that are like, oh, QAnon and the Bilderberg group's running the world. That trilogy proves that no one's in control of anything. If a billion-dollar company couldn't even get their billion-dollar franchise right, if they literally were just like, I don't know, we'll just make it up as we go along, that proves no one's in control of fucking anything.
Crazy.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
That each film is a response to the film that came before it and trying to contradict. Because, you know, and then, you know, I enjoyed that first one, the Force Awakens. But, you know, you realize in the scheme of things, it is just a fuck you to the prequel trilogy.
Yeah.
And then the next one is a fuck you to the first one. And then the third one's a fuck you to the second one. And it's just like, what? This is the most incoherent garbage ever. This is awful.
Yeah.
Awful.
That's, funnily enough, purely by chance, a couple of weeks ago, I just watched a little bit more of Rogue, watched the start of Rogue One, and that to me was like, oh, this is quite nice. It just, like, I don't need another story about the Death Star, but it's a good story about the Death Star, and it's got lots of interesting characters, and it looks magnificent, and that opening with Ben Mendelsohn is fantastic. But anyway, it's pretty fascinating. Hey, a quick aside before we get back into this. You know when Shett and Stanley visit Carl Rodd, who is Harry Dean Stanton. You know, after they drink the coffee, do you think that Chris Isaac didn't hear Sutherland's line because he repeats it?
Oh, does he?
Yeah, because he sort of, I forget what he says, but he says a question and there's silence, and then Sutherland, because Chris Isaac's still looking at the, you know, cup of American, Good Morning America, and then Sutherland sort of says the line again, and Chris Isaac says his line, and Sutherland is smiling, like, and Chris Isaac is kind of giggling. And I reckon...
I'll rewatch it when I get home.
Yeah, I reckon it is David Lynch with the, you know, can you leave us, please? Oh, Jim.
Yeah.
Oh, no, can you leave us, please? I reckon it's that. Yeah,
keep it.
Yeah, but it's great. It really... It's kind of like, for a pretty fucking relentless movie, thanks for keeping that in. It's a shame that Shett isn't around longer. He intuitively knows something is wrong and stays in town. He is intrigued by the noise from a telephone pole that leads him to inspect an empty trailer. This might be the first kind of sense of electricity.
Electricity.
He finds the infamous ring and suddenly vanishes. And why can a simple ring just be so creepy? Like, I
Lord of the Rings, man. Come on.
But that's what I mean. Yeah. Like, how can a simple object just be so skin crawling?
I think that's deep within our makeup as human beings, is to imbue objects with magical power. You know,
or character.
I mean, that goes all that's, you know, more ancient than most of the theistic religions that exist now.
Right.
Is this idea of, know, objects having superstitious forces behind them.
Well, that's inside them. That gets back to the Neanderthal caveman brain of how to recognize something that you should be worried about.
Totally.
And that's why we see faces and trees and things like that.
I mean, you know, obviously a ring, you know, Lord of the Rings is the easy one to go through. But it is incredible in that movie how fucking terrifying that ring is.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and like they'll just have the camera just closing in on it with that gross Mordor. Come on, man.
You know, it's funny. If I looked at that ring on someone's hand, I'd say, nice ring. I see that ring on a little mound of dirt underneath a dirty trailer. And I go, do not touch that. Yeah. You are going to disappear forever.
Totally.
It's fascinating how the ring transports you, and it's important for later on in the story. But now we get to the next scene, which is at the FBI headquarters in Philadelphia, where Dale Cooper realizes something isn't quite right, and the long-lost agent Philip Jeffries reappears after being missing for 2 years. You know, especially on this rewatch and knowing Twin Peaks: The Return, it's hard to disassociate the two. This is one of the most important scenes in the movie, and you could surmise this, to me, is the exact halfway point of the mythology. Let's start with for a movie about Twin Peaks, and once again, getting back to not enjoying it the first time, what an uninspiring way to finally bring Dale Cooper into the picture.
Yeah.
Like, he's just there.
And he's not the Dale Cooper that we remember.
No, because he's younger and he's...
He doesn't have that playfulness or that...
No.
There's something very serious about him.
Yeah.
And very humorless.
Yeah.
There's nothing, not playful at all.
Yeah.
Like, he's freaked out.
Yeah.
And you haven't seen him freaked out prior to, you know, the end of season two, really.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's always kind of in control, or, you know, when... Especially in, you know, we saw it in the movie. He's quite excited
about
things that are happening. He's a little bit like, I know you've never watched Doctor Who, but Tom Baker used to say he's an alien who'll have different reactions to things. So when everyone's freaking out, he'd look at people and go, ooh, it's scary, isn't it?
Yeah,
he's smiling and he's been excited.
Yeah.
Or everyone's having a good time and, oh, yeah, no, yeah, I'm having a great time. So he always played the emotions incorrectly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It is... confronting, and you know, the random security camera thing is once again weird, like, but not like, just moves you to the left a little bit.
Yeah.
And this also feels like it is a precursor for not getting Dale for most of Twin Peaks: The Return. It's like this is kind of letting us know Lynch has no interest or little interest in the idea of nostalgia for his own storytelling.
Thank God. It's so refreshing, man. Yeah. It's so refreshing. I can't, you know, I honestly can't think of any franchise or TV show or whatever that returns after a long time away, or even, you know, after an ending of a kind. I know that season two isn't a definitive ending, but you know, it became the ending.
Yeah.
I really don't know much that returns that had, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think people, once again, I don't think people, the visceral reaction to this film is people don't want that. When things are a trilogy or a storyline, they want different variations on the same theme.
Yeah, which is just, like, that's not, maybe it's just, it's a comforting thought, because, you know, that life is not like that. You can't go back. Which is, I think, interesting why season three... I mean, across the board, season three was really beloved. People love that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So, who knows? Maybe people's perspective on that is changing.
I think...
But, like, you know... Like, my mum loves Sex and the City. She's always loved Sex and the City, and she watched the new ones. And I was like, how was it? And she's like, you know, it was fine. Like,
yeah.
I was like, well, it wasn't great to see those characters again. And she's like, yeah, it was fine. And, like, you know, she's not the kind of person that really thinks deeply about this, you know, TV shows and stuff. But you could see that she couldn't even put her finger on it. It was just like,
yeah,
it's like, it's not, that's over.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of weird 10, 15 years after the fact, like, hey, we're back, Sexing in the City. It's like, really? Like, nothing? Like, it's this, like, you haven't evolved or changed or different people, really?
Well, I think it, I have not quite enough knowledge about this, except for Adam Richard gleefully telling me how much he couldn't stop watching it, even though he wasn't enjoying it.
Yeah.
I think it did change, but not necessarily in a more interesting way. But, you know, that's...
Yeah, everything changed.
Everyone forgets... That series, that original series, was so fantastic and groundbreaking. And then it kind of felt like, often when things get turned into movies, like, this is the opposite. This was like, often they forget, they do the least interesting things more often and bigger in the
extended
movie.
Extended episode.
Except for Lynch, who went, you know, all the things that were a bit creepy. Well, I'm going to double down and really freak you out.
We're going to take out any... Because, you know, like, I'm sure you know, on the Blu-ray, there's basically a movie-length deleted scenes.
Which is also...
Which is all the beloved characters, but they're, like, excised out. Oh, you want a scene with Andy and Lucy? Nah, you're not getting that. And it's true. It would not be appropriate.
Yeah. there's I think there's always been some like hope or hints that, you know, he could edit that all into a 4-hour film, but no. All the rights are taken up with
I wouldn't want to watch it. I mean, I love watching The Missing Pieces as a separate film, as yeah. almost like an appendix.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way to watch it.
Yeah, that is the way to watch it. But I'm sorry, having scenes of fucking Leland Palmer turning into Bob while he molests his daughter, and then the next scene is Andy and Lucy joking about a trumpet or whatever, it's not fucking tonally appropriate.
No. But it is good as an appendix. By the way, I have not gone into that because I would still be working on the script.
I had to
make a real decision.
But you have watched it, right?
Yeah.
It's great. It is like an extra movie.
It is. And because he uses dreamlike logic, because it kind of still follows that with weird edits and things like that.
Yeah.
And you get a lot more of Bowie as well, which takes me to Philip Jeffries is in the movie for 4 minutes, but his scene feels like not just a key to unlocking aspects of the film, but also setting up Twin Peaks: The Return. First of all, let's look at the scene where he points to Cooper, a character he has never met before, and focus on his line, "Who do you think that is there?" And it's interesting. I wonder how much Lynch had in mind leading up to Twin Peaks: The Return, and I wonder how much he had... had a broad feeling of where he wanted to take it and then went back to this film and looked at bits and then got inspired by things that were said.
Yeah, who knows?
Like, it's fascinating. I'm fascinated by that as a writing concept.
Yeah,
it's like the Vince Gilligan thing of, you know, oh, you must have had this planned all from the start. It's like, no. At the start of one season, we gave him a machine gun and we spent the whole season panicking, thinking, fuck, how are we going to pay this off?
Yeah.
You know.
It's
great. This tells us that Philip is wherever he's been, and this speaks to the Black Lodge, it is not tethered to a linear timeline and that it's actually removed from time.
Yep.
So when he comes back, he's looking at Dale, but he's seeing Dale from the future, who is possessed by Bob.
Yes.
Which makes, when you know all of that, makes that scene. That scene, once again, first time I saw it was, here we go. Here we go.
We
never went there.
Or it could be not even the Dale Cooper that's possessed by Bob. It could be the Dale Cooper at the end of season 3 that's, you know, much more kind of cold and detached, which would be in line with how strangely kind of non-present this Dale is.
Right.
It could be layers of weird reality going on.
Yeah.
Shifting reality.
Yeah, you never... It's funny... So much time travel in entertainment kind of sticks to strict rules where it would probably be like this.
Oh, yeah.
Once again, I have a very different interpretation now.
Right.
This will all affect it. He then mentions that Judy is not to be talked about before speaking about a reunion in the room above the convenience store that includes the little man, Bob, Mrs. Chalfont, her grandson, the jumping man, two woodsmen, and the electrician.
That fucking jumping man is one of the most disgusting things on earth.
Yeah.
It's just...
Yeah.
That was another moment where I audibly was like, come on. And the camera going down is... disgusting wet maw.
I'm creeped out more by the mundane in places that shouldn't make sense than I am by, you know, a ghost gushing blood knives for eyes.
Absolutely.
Them all just sitting around and laughing in a place that looks like it's full of hepatitis is fucking terrifying.
Eating creamed corn.
what a perfect scary food to
Garmin
introduce.
Bozier.
Oh my God. Do you have a theory on what is happening with these spirits in the convenience store? Because, you know, once again, I don't think there is any right or wrong, but do you have a theory?
I just think it's the place. I think it's, you know, it's almost like that part inside every person's skull where all their fucking demons reside.
Right.
You know, waiting to unleash.
Right.
I think that place is disturbing because it's a disturbingly familiar place.
Yeah.
You know, all of those, you know, because I really do believe that we are all a caucus. You know, there's no one self. There's many, many entities living in us. I don't believe that they're external entities. I just, you know, there's, you know, it sounds like I'm talking about some kind of schizophrenia. That's not what I mean at all. But, you know, it's the many voices in your head.
It's almost as... But it's like the mundane side of how many times have you met someone and they've said, oh, wait till you meet my husband. He's one of the funniest people you've ever met. You'll really love him. And then you meet him and he is one of the most tedious asshats you've ever met. But at some point when he's hanging out with his wife, he's really funny. It makes her laugh.
Exactly. Yeah, and it just, like, it feels like all of those, you know, it's almost like Lynch has put a physical presence into all of these different versions of kind of grotty, demonic forces that exist in your own head.
Yeah. So is the Jumping Man the one that freaks you out the most?
Yeah, because it's that whole uncanny valley movement. And, you know, then it's replicated later on with the boy, when he, which again is another one moment that made me yell out when Leland leaves the the motel after he realizes that he's booked a fuck session with his own daughter.
Jesus.
And runs away. And then the little boy suddenly just jumps out of the bushes. Oh, come on, man.
Yeah.
And again, you can't even, you know, you describe it. It's like, oh, yeah. Like in any other director's hands, that would be like a hack, you know, kind of like, oh, and then a creepy boy with a weird paper mache mask jumps out of the bushes and hops around like a bunny rabbit and disappears.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, okay, that sounds so lame. And in the hands of this guy, it is like, get fucked, man. Please, just leave me alone.
So this was, you know, as we keep talking about, part of the fun of a Lynch movie and is the further he goes in his career, he leans into ambiguity more and that allows you to kind of interpret or reinterpret. This time when I was watching it, this to me feels like the primordial spirits who have existed well before humans were anything like we are now. And with Twin Peaks, The Return in mind, specifically episode 8, when the atomic bomb was detonated in Los Alamos in 1945, these spirits found a crack in the skin of the universe and were able to return. And all of these spirits have their own agendas that we don't understand.
Yeah.
And only through our narrow focus of what it means to be human do these spirits correspond with any sense of right or wrong or good or evil. Yes. But they're kind of beyond that.
Yeah. No, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And now we finally return to Twin Peaks. It's a hell of a prologue.
Yep.
That I love this time compared to the first time. Once again, the first time I was like, when are we getting to Twin Peaks?
Yeah.
How do you feel about returning to the final days of Laura Palmer?
You know, it can't not be imbued with a real sense of dread.
Yeah.
And I think, again, it's hard to say because, you know, I know what's going to happen. But, you know, going into it this time, I felt this immense kind of weight on me because it was... I don't even think we returned to Twin Peaks with the familiar music. I think we're suddenly... It is?
Yeah,
okay, right. But I think that everything that's come before it lets us know that it's not going to be the, you know, fun, familiar Twin Peaks that we're used to. It's going to be... And nor should it be, because now, you know, once you realize that you're going to see the final days of Laura Palmer, it's not going to be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not fun, but it's an extraordinary performance by Cheryl Lee. It's incredible. In hindsight, completely ahead of the curve, because with so many movies, TV shows and novels, etc., relying on the dead woman trope to move a story forward. In 1993, going back and fleshing out this character of Laura as an actual person and removing her from the MacGuffin-esque role that she occupied is a stroke of genius.
Yep.
And I'm not the first person to notice that. I think we'll get into it later, but your favourite reviewer was the first person who suggested this, which helped shift the commode. Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, beyond anything, it's a fucking hell of a performance. It's one of those performances where you're like, how did you get through this shoot?
Yeah.
What the amount of hardcore emotion and the places that you're going.
Yeah.
Even that, the one that really affected me was after she runs out of the house and she's hiding in the bushes and she sees her dad leaving. Yeah. And there's this guttural kind of husk that's coming out of her as she's sobbing. And it's... I mean, I couldn't even look at it as acting. It's like, where are you, what place have you gone to? Because that's real.
Yeah.
That's a really real, raw emotion. And I've seen interviews with her where she talked about how exhausting the shoot was, and it was only because she trusted David so much that she, you know, went there.
Yeah. Yeah, she has a, you know, watching interviews for this, she has such affection for him.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a trust.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's really interesting that you, what you were just talking about with people having different aspects to their personality. Mm. And what's great about this movie is we see all the different aspects of Laura. Mm. There's the sweet high school girl. There's the drug-taking, dangerous Laura. There's scared Laura. She's cruel and caring. Yep. She's funny and serious. She's in control. She's out of control. She's innocent and she's seductive.
Yep.
And it often feels like there's moments where she's attempting to destroy Laura before Bob can finish the job.
Yep.
Was there a particular moment with Laura that stood out for you?
I think it's what you say. I think it's these shifting personality tropes, and maybe that, you know, I think, again, when I was younger, I might have looked at that and thought that it was inconsistent or contradictory. Yeah. Whereas you get a bit older and you're like, oh, no.
No, that's people.
That's people.
You know, weirdly, my favorite scene is when Donna accompanies her on the night out and she tries to act like Laura, and that's the way Laura snaps out of her self-destruction to save her friend. But she can't articulate it either. All she can say is, don't wear my things, you know, but it's that's
but not. Also there's that malicious, you know, teenage part of her that kind of gets Donna into it. Drink up, Donna.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, she kind of gets her into that situation.
Yeah, and let's then, rock.
Yeah, let's you rock know? Yeah, and you then know? Something kicks in, you know, again, just these kind of conflicting personality traits that when you're kind of less experienced in life, you might think are contradictory.
Yeah.
And they are contradictory, but that's the point, you know.
That's why people are people,
yep.
You know. Yep. You know, because this movie is not tethered to linear storytelling, let's just get straight into Laura's relationship with Leland. Mm. Of course, you can view this as being possessed by some type of evil spirit, but you can also view this as an unfortunately realistic relationship with the respectable businessman who is a monster to his family as well. With that in mind, it suddenly shines a new light on Sarah Palmer, Laura's mum.
Oh, man.
It's a completely different performance when you look at it that way.
It is horrific, that kind of silent complicity.
Yeah.
And there's a few looks that she gives, especially in that horrific scene of Laura's hands are dirty.
Yes, yes.
Which is, I mean, obviously the more graphic scenes are much more disturbed, but everything that implies is so, so disgusting.
Yeah.
That scene is so disgusting, and the power and the control and the fact that the mother's just sitting there, you know, her eyes darting around, looking at the whole thing unfold, knowing, fully understanding what is happening here.
Yeah.
But through her own trauma and her own being ground down, being unable or unwilling to intervene.
Yeah.
It's horrific.
And so getting a different take on Sarah is really fascinating. Yeah. Once again, we've talked about how if you took away the prologue, you could just view this as a young girl trying to create a world that makes sense of the awfulness that's happening to her, which also, if we get into another theory on Leland, we've learnt over through the third season that Leland was possessed by Bob when he met a strange neighbour who was the demonic entity. Mm. And this is also a metaphor for some people who commit these types of heinous crimes on their children are often the victims of those crimes themselves.
Yeah.
So here's my question for you. Is it possessed Leland who is having sex with Theresa Banks, or is it normal Leland? And in that regard, is it possessed Leland seeing Laura thinking, I'm going to get caught out, I have to get out of here? Or is it normal Leland who's having sex with Theresa Palmer who sees it and then goes, oh no, this is too much?
I honestly think they're one and the same. I think that the, you know, much like Laura saying, let's rock, drink up to Donna, and then suddenly kind of coming down from the high of that malicious headspace and going, wait, what have I done? Fuck, I think it's very much that with Leland. I think that he's overtaken with these just horrific dark moods or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
You know, I think he is not possessed by a demon. I think he is possessed by the very dark forces in his own brain that take over and cloud any kind of morality or any kind of restraint or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think just in that moment where he sees Laura in the hotel room, it's maybe his better angels come to the surface, or maybe he's like, you know, this is not the context in which I do this with her.
Yeah.
The context in which I do this with her is one where there are no witnesses,
yeah.
where there is more power and control on my end.
Yeah.
And so he runs away. I mean, it's like, it's such, I think it's one of the darkest, I mean, it's an incredibly brave performance on Ray Wise's part.
Yeah.
It's an incredible performance.
Yeah.
But it is one of the darkest, most disturbing performances I've ever seen in any film or anything.
Oh.
I mean, it's up there with something in Snowtown or something. It is so fucking dark.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't even imagine what the energy on set would have been like.
Yeah.
It's so fucked up, man.
Oh, man, you know. And then you have things like Mrs. Chalfont and her grandson handing over the painting and telling Laura that the man behind the mask is in Laura's room, thus informing her that Leland is Bob, which that scene is terrifying in its banality. Would you have hung that painting up in your bedroom?
I would have fucking burned it on a fucking pyre.
I would have killed both of them with the painting and then run screaming into wherever I could run. And then we have Laura dreaming about Dale in the Black Lodge and he tells her not to take the ring. Mm. And then when she wakes to find Annie Blackburn next to her in the bed. See, that was another storyline I wanted finished as well, because I loved Annie.
Yeah.
But
it's so interesting watching it free of the context of Twin Peaks, right? That moment.
Yeah.
You're just like, oh, it's just a surreal moment. Like, who's that?
This is a story about women always being murdered and the agents who tried to save them disappearing. You can read it absolutely, that way as well, you know. Once again, you know, she says you got that good Dale is trapped and can't leave and you should write it in your diary, which once again informs that the Black Lodge is beyond our comprehension where it exists in time compared to our linear world. And that will also tie into my new theory. All the scenes with Jacques Renault are so awful, but there is a... we've already talked about the subtitles. Mm. That scene just really, as you summarized, it really makes you feel like you're there and it makes you angry that you're there.
Yeah.
It's like one of those places when you've had a great night out and you just, hey, what's that pub over there? I don't want to go home. Yeah, let's go in there. And like within three steps, for some reason, you want to leave, but because you've taken three steps in, you have to stay for one drink.
Yeah.
It would actually be worse to leave immediately for some reason.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, you might anger someone.
Yeah. So the moment when Laura looks over and sees Donna naked on her back, making out with that awful guy, reminded me of the painting The Nightmare by Swiss artist Henry Fuseli. Do you know that painting?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The succubus sitting on the woman's chest.
Yeah, for anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about, it's a woman in deep sleep with her arms thrown below her and with a demonic incubus or succubus crouched on her chest and a pale horse with blank eyes watching on. Little known fact, when I was reading about this, Mary Shelley's parents were friends with that guy and that may have been an influence on Frankenstein. But anyway, that's just a little side note. But then the moment where Mike begins shouting at Leland is another one of those moments that could happen in the real world. But because of the story that's being told, it's imbued with this otherworldly horror, especially as Laura watches.
That was another scene where I really freaked out watching that. Because I don't know if it was the mixing on the soundtrack, but everything just got like really absurdly loud in my little apartment during that sequence.
Yeah.
And by the end, I was holding my head like Laura was, just like, can't, like, stop.
Yeah.
It's too intense.
Yeah. It's so funny. It's a guy shouting at another guy in a car and it's just fucking horrific.
It's awful. And again, the...
all the noises. My Lord. The further the movie goes as well, the further it unravels and storytelling conventions disappear with it. Do you feel that when Laura sees the angel disappear from her painting, that she kind of knows she doesn't have long?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm falling and falling. You keep falling and falling faster and faster through space and not even the angels can save you.
Yeah. Before we arrive at the finale, Laura's mum has a vision of a pale horse to this is one of my fucking spirals into a hole of reading about it. But to interpret this, we have to return to episode 7 of season 2 of Twin Peaks, where Sarah sees the horse and immediately has a moment of relief and pleasure. How did you interpret the horse before I give you two looks at it?
I interpreted in that, in the, you know, the pale horse, the pale rider kind of thing, you know, as an ominous sign.
Yeah.
I knew that it had appeared previously in the show, but I had forgotten, and I was kind of glad I'd forgotten, because again, I was in this mode of watching it free of the series.
Yeah. I'd forgotten too. I had to, as I said, do a bit of reading and then it popped up and I was like, oh yeah, this. So you can kind of look at it in two ways. It's either the pale horse that death rides or the traditional white horse that provides protection.
Mm.
If we think of death, say, in the tarot, it's often interpreted as change as well.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe this is the beginning of her pain being taken away, and then therefore she turns into that person we see in Twin Peaks, The Return.
Yeah.
Because everything's beyond our comprehension with these spirits.
Mm.
It feels like it's neither good nor bad. It just is.
Mm, yeah.
The final scene with Jacques and Leo, followed by Leland making his way in, is honestly one of the most horrific and sickening scenes I've experienced in a film. Once again, when I was young, too much. But this time, though, I notice there is a moment of triumph when Laura wears the ring, which stops Bob from being able to go inside of her.
Mm.
How did you interpret this ending?
The ending in the train carriage.
Yeah.
I maybe interpreted it as darker. There's... because there's the moment where the angel appears for Renette Polanski.
Yeah.
And she's not granted a mercy. There's no mercy in this.
No.
But it allows her to escape the final fate of being killed. The fact that the angel doesn't present itself or give Laura that mercy, there's a cruelty in that that I found really disturbing.
Right.
Like, really. This viewing really, it really fucked me up last night.
Yeah.
It's a really full-on movie. I mean, of course, we get the coda at the end, which, you know, there's a sense of grace, I suppose. But, to be honest, by the time Leland's running them through the woods and there's that fucked up torchlight and he looks like an insane, like he's riding a chariot or something just off his head.
Yeah.
And they're screaming and I was completely harrowed by them. Yeah. Like, just enough. I mean, and you know, everything that's come before it as well.
Yeah.
You know, the dehumanization that they go through in the cabin with Jacques Renault and Leo, and it's awful. Everything's so awful.
Yeah.
And you know, of course, and her continued mental breakdown. I mean, we haven't talked about the scene with Bobby killing that guy.
Oh yeah.
But Laura's reaction to that is so fucked up.
Yeah.
You know, you killed Mike.
Yeah.
You killed Mike.
Yeah. And she's just is she's gone. Yeah.
She's gone.
Yeah. And you know, that's kind of, you know, the angel's gone, she's gone, she is, you know. It's also, I haven't really talked about the other characters, but you know, even with James, there's the moment where, you know, we kept coming to the stoplight in the original Twin Peaks, and now we kind of, like, this is kind of the reverse of finding out how Han Solo got his name. Now we look at the stoplight, we go, oh, that was kind of potentially the turning point of where she could have been saved.
Totally.
And, you know, he doesn't really know what to do in that moment. It goes
he's
green.
He's a kid.
And he's a kid.
He's a kid.
He's such a... that poor character. He's such a nice character, James, isn't he? Also, once again, Bobby is a... I hated Bobby as a youngster, but now I kind of have weird affection for Bobby.
Yeah.
You know, the way she manipulates him as well so easily at the start.
Oh, that's a great scene, right?
Yeah, where he's so angry. Where have you been? And then he's just like, woo!
Yeah.
Laura,
and everyone's dancing. Everyone in the school's dancing. Like it's some kind of West Side Story.
Yeah, it's 500 days of winter. So I think there is, because the ring transports people to the Black Lodge, I think there is a slight triumph of her being able to escape demonic possession and get somewhere that he can't inflict that upon her. So Bob returns to the Black Lodge, where he feeds Mark and the arm there, scum on balls, yeah. And Laura's body is left to drift away and be found the next morning by Will Hayward. We then see Laura's spirit in the Red Room and she notices Agent Cooper at her side with his hand on her shoulder comforting her. An angel appears. She begins to cry and laugh with the movie ending. So, so you just kind of find that to be just like the tiniest moment of grace.
Well, you know, it's almost like... It's almost like, you know, some kind of grace and peace just found in the end of, you know, the horror of life or something. Like, yeah. I mean, I know that there's an interpretation of this film of like, oh, it's a glorious, celebratory, beautiful ending.
Yeah.
I have a harder time with that interpretation just because of all the horror that's preceded. It's like, yeah. You know, if the peace that comes can only come through getting your head stoved in and stabbed to death by your father that's been molesting you your whole life. It's like, yeah. I don't know how fucking graceful and beautiful that is. It's pretty fucking awful.
Yeah.
I'm glad at the end that she's laughing and there's an angel there.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know if it's an ending that I can hang my hat of hope onto.
Yeah. Well, that's how I used to feel about it. And I've completely turned on this watch. So you have to keep bringing Twin Peaks, The Return, and the theory that you watch the final two episodes at the same time and that things don't actually take place the way we watch them. They actually take place in a different scope.
Yeah.
And so if you take that into account, I now believe this ending takes place beyond the end of the third season.
Right.
And I think this is not only the moment that Laura is freed from the cycle of violence, and I kind of now interpret the, you know, this is just my interpretation, I now interpret the European movie as one cycle, and then there's the series.
Right.
So, you know, and we've seen Dale has to kind of, he says in that final two episodes, he says to everyone, hey, you've all been really good friends and I hope to see you again.
Yeah.
But he's not going to because he changes everything. He goes back and she will return to a world where Twin Peaks is a place. He changes history.
Yeah.
And he takes the Black Lodge out.
Right.
So Twin Peaks, she will grow up as Laura Palmer in a place that is full of characters that are good and bad. And good things happen and bad things happen, but they're safe from the inhabitants of the Black Lodge. I think Dale Cooper learns the lessons of life and dreams the dream where living plays out the way it is supposed to and not manipulated by these spirits that are beyond good or evil.
Yeah, right.
On a meta level, I am heavily influenced by the ending of The Elephant Man and Wild at Heart. Mm. He actually likes a lot of happy endings. He likes to bring relief.
Yes.
And then... if we take into account, Gordon is told in Twin Peaks The Return, where Monica Bellucci tells him, and it's actually Monica Bellucci, yeah, <no. laughs> we are the dreamer who dreams and then lives inside the dream, but who is the dreamer?
Yeah.
Gordon then turns around and sees himself as a young man in Fire Walk With Me.
Yeah.
Well, the dreamer in our world is Lynch. And he is reminded of his younger self, and though he doesn't want to give us an ending that is explained, my interpretation is that he is an older man, and he does give us a happy ending. Right. He is reminded of his mortality, and therefore he dreams of an end where Dale finally learns the right lessons and helps Laura live the life she deserves.
Oh, that's beautiful.
That's my interpretation.
That's very beautiful.
But it's,
you know, it's great that it's completely plausible, viable interpretation.
Yeah, and it could be, you know, completely wrong, or it could be...
Well, it's right, but it's not wrong. It's right. It's right for you.
It's right for me.
Yeah.
But that's how I took all of those visions of an older Gordon seeing a younger Gordon. He is the dreamer who has dreamed this up and placed himself not unlike a Grant Morrison, King Mob, Fanny... fiction suit, and he is finally giving us the happy ending. He's just so when Dale goes and finds Carrie and they're in the real world, which helps break, like, that is, she remembers everything.
Yeah.
And I feel like this scene is now after that, where they are both in the Black Lodge and he's letting her know what you know has now never happened, and now you're going to go back and live your life, and I'm beautiful. never And this is like the last time I'm going to know you. Like, yeah, this is Dale Cooper saying, I'm never even going to remember that I did this.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, like, it's beyond ego.
Yeah, beautiful.
And so...
Yeah. Now you're making me want to watch the whole fucking thing again.
Let's do it! I was really excited when I came up with this, and I thought... and it was really hard not to ring you and say... Hey, I've got this idea, and I thought, hold on, just write it down. But it feels, I say this completely that I'm viewing this through the prism of a pretty fucked up year, and we're going to talk about Lost Highway next, and that's a pretty fascinating film, but I feel like it's. It doesn't feel like I'm imposing anything that isn't there. It's just me taking what is there and assembling it into a way
And as we talked about, like, what other director could you do this with?
Right.
You know? That's the beauty of his work.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of the dream/nightmare logic. It is open to several interpretations.
Yeah.
And whatever, you know. And you could watch it again in 5 years and have something completely different that you've never even conceived of before.
Yeah. And we'll get in the squid bits that we'll just go through quickly. The, you know, if you kind of look at it as thing, you know, things keep repeating, you know, and Philip Jeffries is potentially with Judy and things go awry. Chet is with Teresa Banks, things go awry. And Dale goes with Laura. How many times has he experienced this? And he, in that time, he's the one. So it doesn't discount Dale at all. Finally, he learns exactly what he needs to learn to do the right thing by everyone, and specifically Laura. Even if he'll never know, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Yeah, perfect.
Yep. So some squid bits. Kyle MacLachlan was reluctant to return as Dale Cooper because he was afraid of being typecast. Mm-hmm. He also didn't like the direction of the show in season two. And since the movie was announced 1 month after the final episode aired, he wasn't interested. And that's why his presence in the film is smaller than originally planned. Mm. Chester Desmond was created to cover the lack of Dale Cooper. His creation also does contradict the Twin Peaks tie-in book, The Autobiography of FBI Agents Dale Cooper, My Life, My Tapes. But once again, it is one of those things where, because I feel like this has been a cycle of violence and this has been happening over and over again, I feel like that's maybe those tapes are the movie. Yeah. You know, once again, that's how you can kind of move it all together.
Yeah, or parallel reality or whatever.
Yeah. Cheryl and Fenn didn't return because of scheduling conflicts, and Lara Flynn Boyle just declined, just didn't want to do it.
It's strange, right?
It's strange.
I heard it was because of the nudity. Was it?
Yeah, yeah, maybe. I don't know. Mark Frost also had a falling out with Lynch over whether it should be a prequel or a straightforward sequel to season two, hence why he didn't work on the film.
Right.
The movie was booed at the 1992 Cannes Film Festival and received negative reviews in the States. This helped lead the film to a poor box office, along with that it came out a year after the series had finished.
Yeah.
And we have to remember that it finished due to declining viewing numbers. Yeah. It was just incomprehensible to fans, people who weren't fans of Twin Peaks. And even then, it only appeals to a certain percentage of those who are fans. some of the criticisms, Vincent Canby for the New York Times. This is possibly one of the funniest negative reviews. It's not the worst movie ever made. It just seems to be.
Wow.
Funny, like, you know what? If you're going to be cruel, be funny.
Has there been another film that has been so critically reappraised so far after its release?
Good question. Yeah, let's have a think about that. Yeah. Quentin Tarantino said that Lynch had disappeared so far up his own ass that I have no desire to see another David Lynch movie until I hear something different. Irony!
Oh, Quentin.
In good news, commercial hit in Japan.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, Japan.
Good on you, Japan.
Wow.
So it wasn't until 2012 when Mark Kermode described the movie as maligned but frankly marvellous in one of his video series that the tide began to change a little bit.
Love Kermode.
I think he may have been the first person to suggest that, you know, fleshing her out as a character is, and, you know, Some history on the Blue Rose Task Force in Twin Peaks lore. We go back to Olympia, Washington in 1975 when a woman called Lois Duffy murdered her own Tolper, who said, and the Tolper said, "I'm like the Blue Rose," before dying and disappearing. The case was investigated by FBI agents Gordon Cole and Philip Jeffries,
yes,
and the final words were used in naming the task force. Duffy is then indicted for murder and commits suicide. So that's where the Blue Rose comes from. A Blue Rose symbolizes mystery or attaining the impossible, and because of genetic limitations, they do not exist in nature.
That's right.
The woman in the diner at Haps says in French, "Nighttime is the right time," which is the title of a 1957 song recorded by Big Bill Brunzi and later covered by people like Ray Charles and James Brown. Yet, I saw a little bit of conjecture online that maybe she is saying, "Henry, he's not funny." And you know what? They're probably both right.
That old man.
Yeah.
Are you talking about that murdered little girl?
Yeah. And both lines sound like they could be, like, you could imagine that woman saying, "Nighttime is the right time." Oh, yeah, that sounds right. Yeah. "Henry, he's not funny." Yeah, that sounds about right as well. In the original scripts, co-writer Robert Engel said in an interview for Wrapped in Plastic that Judy was either going to be Josie Packard's sister and or possibly another murdered woman who leads an FBI agent to investigate and then subsequently disappear, as I just mentioned, like Therese Banks and Chet, Laura Palmer and Dale. When the script was revised, they altered aspects of Judy's identity.
There's more meat to that scene in the deleted...
Yes.
Missing pieces.
Yeah.
You actually see Philip Jeffries at the hotel in Columbia or wherever he is.
Yeah. Some if you're a Bowie fan, some...
It's great.
It's great. One of the many tragedies of David Bowie dying is... would he have been in Twin Peaks?
I think he would have.
Like, he didn't like to do too much stuff, but I reckon...
He would have been Lynch there for Lynch. Would have,
Don't get me wrong. I like that Bowie became a steam...
A tea kettle.
Garmin Bosia isn't a real word. It appears to be a negative energy created by pain and suffering, and the bad spirits in the Black Lodge manipulate normal people into these experiences so they can feed on it.
Yep.
As a substance, creamed corn.
And they eat it very sensually.
Oh, God.
A lot of lip smacking.
Oh, mate.
Very slow and sensual.
Yeah,
as each kernel goes down.
Actually, you know what?
It's disgusting.
Tarantino, you might say this movie was fucking up its own ass, but who eats exactly like that in Death Proof?
Ah, very good.
Bingo.
Yeah.
I'll see you outside behind the school sheds later, Tarantino. It may be an evil version of ambrosia, which in Greek mythology is the food or drink of the gods.
Right.
So maybe
that's what
it is. Lynch stated in his memoir, Catching the Big Fish, that the Red Room flashed fully formed into his head when he touched a hot car outside a film lab one summer night.
Of course it did.
Once again, I could have gone on forever with squid bits, but I'm going to finish with this one, which will just lighten the mood. The Fire Walk With Me soundtrack has Lynch and Badalamenti's first attempt at rap music. The vocal is so weird that Lynch said it caused him to laugh himself into a hernia. This is the quote. Angelo said, "Let me give this a try." So I went over all the lyrics with him and he went into the recording booth and Angelo came to life in this booth. I was with the engineer and I was laughing so hard that something exploded. It was like a light bulb blew up in my stomach and that was the end of my stomach wall.
I would love to see David Lynch in hysterical peals of laughter.
So would I. Oh, man. What an image, right?
Yeah.
Well, a dark...
Yeah.
Journey.
I think the darkest film he's made.
Yeah. But I hope that my interpretation has brought...
Absolutely.
A genuine sense of relief.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm glad we were able to navigate this conversation. I was like a little bit kind of hesitant to even talk about this.
Mate, this is why...
It's full on.
This is why this goddamn script took me nearly 14 hours to get right, because... Once again, I know we've given warnings and everything, but I still don't want... Like, I want people to listen and have, you know, even if they haven't watched it, they've had something interesting to listen to.
Yeah,
I don't want to be freaking them out at the same
but,
time.
You know, this is also the fucking, you know, we're living on a dark planet, guys.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, if you have watched Twin Peaks and you thought that it ended in a dark way, or if you haven't watched Twin Peaks and you've heard that it's dark, well, hopefully my interpretation has brought just a little bit of light to your world. Next up, Lost Highway.
Lost Highway.
Big thank you to Ben Elwood for joining me not only today, but on this journey through the work of David Lynch. You know, we're starting to get close to the end of the David Lynch movies, so maybe we'll put up a poll on who we might tackle next. We've got some thoughts, but yeah, I might put that over at the Patreon page and just get some initial ideas. Look, to be honest, I'm not saying we're definitely going to take it on board, but I am curious. You might make a suggestion that makes us think, yes, let's do that person. So mainstream, not mainstream, whatever. I don't mind what it is, but I'd love to know who your favourite directors are or who's a director that maybe you're curious about and you'd like to know more about. And, you know, sometimes, as with the Sofia Coppola series, that was a real series that was an eye-opener for me as well. She's gone from making some films that I like to being one of my favourite directors. So I am totally up for someone that I'm not that au fait with as well. The next David Lynch film is Lost Highway. Yes, one of my all-time favourite films. So look out for that in the near future. A big thank you to Philip Boothby for your patronage, and I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you've watched this movie, let me know if you agree with Ben or you agree with me, or if you started agreeing with Ben and I won you over, or if you agreed with me and Ben took you down into his grubby view of life. A reminder for all of my Patreon subscribers, there's a new Dispatches from the Fury Road podcast that was uploaded earlier this week. I mentioned it at the start of this podcast. This one covered the latest season of Atlanta. You've probably heard me bang on about how much I love Atlanta. I love this latest season. Some people did not. And so this podcast was asking what responsibility the artist has towards the consumer. If you think you'd like to have access to that podcast and more, head over to patreon.com/JustinHamilton_BigSquid. By the way, if money is tight, but you'd still like to support our work here, you can just help out by leaving a top review on Apple Podcasts or even suggest Big Squid to any of your friends you think that might enjoy what my mates and I are doing. So, you know, it all helps out. And just by listening, you are supporting. So thank you very much as well. Once again, a quick reminder for Adelaide listeners. I'll be there on June the 3rd at the Rhino Room. And if you're keen to come along, use the Big Squid promo code HAMMO, HAMMO, to buy a discounted ticket and hang around in the front bar. We can have a chat afterwards. Next week, we have a two-part Space Podyssey episode with Rove McManus. He's back. He's back from WA, baby, joining Ben and me to discuss Galaxy Quest, a movie I hadn't seen before, and I'm very glad I have now experienced it. What a treat of a film. Just some good people tell me that it was great, and I'd never gotten around to it. So Rove suggested this movie, and I'm so glad that he did because I loved it. You have the weekend to watch the film, if you want, before the podcast drops next week. Let's finish today's episode with a quote from Laura Palmer herself, the actor Cheryl Lee. "The more we deny that we have a dark side, the more power it has over us." Good quote, and kind of ties into some of the stuff that Ben often discusses on this podcast as well. So I thought, here we go. What a perfect way to finish today's episode. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you listening. Until then.